Hello and welcome to Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio, big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. I'm your aptly named host. Oh, I'm glad you're with me. I'd go into verbigeration if you repeated the idea that you missed today's show. Your cyber risk. Bad things can happen to all that data you store on donors, volunteers, employees, vendors, and others. But there are ways to minimize your risk and protect your nonprofit if a breach occurs. Mark Schein of Marsh & McLennan Agency shares his wisdom. And beyond online to IRL. Maria Semple, our prospect research contributor and the prospect finder, reminds you that real-life conversations, remember those little things, can tell you so much more about your potential donors than online research. Plus, she has conferences you need to know about. On Tony's Take Two, I'm wagging my finger. We're sponsored by Pursuant, full-service fundraising, data-driven and technology-enabled. You'll raise more money. Pursuant.com. And by WeBe Spelling, super cool spelling bee fundraisers, WeBeeSpelling.com. Here is Mark Schein with your cyber risk. I'm very glad to welcome Mark Schein to the studio. He is a risk management consultant with Marsh & McLennan Agency and an authority on cyber insurance, providing strategies to protect sensitive employee, customer, and business information. He's a CIC, a CLCS, and RIM. Find out that very shortly. And the company is at mma-ne.com. Mark is at mschein, that's S-C-H-E-I-N, CIC, CLCS. Mark, welcome to the studio.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Come a little closer to the mic so we can hear you even
sure.
Better. Okay. We want to talk about cyber exposure. Define it for us first, so everybody's talking about the same thing.
Sure. So when we look at a cyber attack, you know, certain industries think that it has to do with a nation state coming and hacking and things of that nature, which it does.
Could be.
Which it does, absolutely.
Okay.
But there's other exposures that really come to light as well. The idea we look at information and the type of information that businesses or not-for-profits have. And it really falls into three silos: personally identifiable information, PII, non-public names, phone numbers, social security numbers, email addresses, physical addresses, things of that nature.
Okay.
Then when we look at PCI, the payment card industry, that's really looking at the credit cards. How many credit cards do you have on file? That kind of information. And then you take a look at PHI information, which is the healthcare information. And so we look at it from three different segments. And for non-for-profits, when we take a look at it, typically the way that they're asking their donors to donate is via a website. And when they go onto the website, typically what we've seen from our clients is you have to put in your name, your address, your email address.
A lot of personal info.
A tremendous amount.
All right.
And then
they
ask you for your credit card information in order to make the donation. So now when we look at non-for-profits, several years ago, the cyber exposure didn't necessarily exist. Now there's certain first-party legal responsibilities in the event of a data breach that these nonprofits have to comply with.
Okay, okay. And you mentioned a whole bunch of acronyms, PCI and,
PCI.
And PPI, which I'm glad you defined, because on Nonprofit Radio we have Jargon Jail.
Sure.
And I would hate to put you in there at the outset. And it reminds me that I forgot to go back and look at your acronym. So you got a bunch of letters after your name.
Yes.
A CIC. What's a CIC?
Yep. Commercial Certified Insurance Counselor.
Certified. You even get confused yourself.
Yeah. There's okay. so many C's after my name that.
Okay. Yeah. There are three. Okay. So Certified Insurance Counselor, and then you're also a CLCS.
Yes. Commercial Lines Coverage Specialist.
Commercial Lines Coverage Specialist. Now you must be especially proud of those because those are in your Twitter ID.
Yes.
Okay. But then RIM. What's this RIMing work? You do? What's RIM?
I'm not sure what the RIM that you're referring to.
RIM. RIM.
The RIM Council. I sit on the RIM Council for the Poneman Institute, which is the leading organization for cyber stats in the country.
Cyber stats. Oh, Poneman.
The Poneman Institute, correct.
It looks like Pokemon, but it's not Poneman.
Poneman, okay. Exactly.
Okay. And RIM is Responsible Information Management.
Correct.
At the Pokemon Institute. No, at the Poneman Institute.
The Poneman Institute, Poneman, correct.
Poneman. Sorry. All right. Thank you. Okay. All right. So we got your credentials are clear. You got a lot of letters, a lot of... professional certifications.
Yep.
All right. Now, I mean, when we think of cyber breaches,
I think of Yahoo and Target mm-hmm. and even the Democratic National Committee. I mean, so if these highly sophisticated organizations, I think, I mean, at least in terms of IT, I would think that they are vulnerable, then surely small and mid-sized nonprofits have vulnerabilities to be concerned about.
Sure. So what you're saying, and again, we're not going to comment on any specific client just because of the nature of the business and who we are, but what we'll talk about is the exposures that they all do face.
Yeah. And I mean, if these big organizations are at risk, well, I mean, Yahoo, 500 million user IDs and, you know, passwords and things, right? I mean, this is...
So again, when you're looking at a hacker, forgetting who the company is, yeah. when you take a look at the breaches that are going on, they are now targeting the vendors of some of these larger entities because they realize that the vendors don't have the same protocols. They don't have the same budgets to implement these cybersecurity best practices that some of the Fortune 1000 companies that, you know, you've previously mentioned have.
Oh, all right. So sometimes it's a contractor.
Exactly. It's the low-hanging fruit that they're looking for.
All right.
Hackers are lazy. They don't want to work any harder than anybody else does. Okay. So if they're able to get into a smaller entity who has access into another larger entities, well, that could be the treasure trove that they were just looking for.
Okay. So that raises a good point. If we are outsourcing any database management in terms of the type of mm-hmm. data that you were talking about, those three different categories, we need to be sure that the vendors we're hiring have either insurance, well, insurance, which you and I are going to talk about, and really should be, and high levels of security.
Correct.
So we got to make sure our subcontractors, our vendors, basically.
You want to make sure that you're doing your due diligence when it comes to your vendor selection. That's a very important step. And it's something that businesses are now starting to pick up on. It's something at Marsh Marsh McLennan Agencies that we recommend when we're talking to our clients. So you hit the nail on the head.
Okay, cool. It doesn't happen often. So thank you for acknowledging one of the rare instances. All right. All right. Now, if we happen to be a target or a victim of a cyber exposure, the first thing that occurs to me is bad press.
Yeah.
What other risks are we suffering? I mean, not in terms of the data, but just in terms of costs and things like that.
Sure. So when you look at a data breach and you see what the average cost of a data breach was, and, you know, the Poneman Institute, which we just referenced, the average cost of a data breach was about $7 million in 2016.
Yeah.
And when we look at it, what are the first party legal responsibilities that the business has or the nonprofit has to do in the event of a data breach? First, they have to notify, they put in a call to their cyber insurance broker. They want to put the carrier on notice. Let them know that the possibility of a claim might be coming down the pipeline. Let them work with the preferred providers that the cyber insurance provides to the entity. Then they'll work with the data breach coach, which is the attorney who will let them know what their first party legal responsibilities are moving forward.
Yeah. All right.
And then the notification, because you not only have to notify the affected individuals in your non-for-profit that were affected, but you also have to notify the estate attorney generals where those individuals reside as well.
Okay. All right. We're going to unpack some of that. We got to go out for a break.
Sure.
When we come back, Mark and I are going to keep talking about that and some of the hard costs of recovery. And then, of course, the ways of insuring against a loss. Stay with us.
You're tuned to Nonprofit Radio. Tony Martinetti also hosts a podcast for the Chronicle of Philanthropy. Fundraising Fundamentals is a quick, 10-minute burst of fundraising insights published once a month. Tony's guests are expert in crowdfunding, mobile giving, event fundraising, direct mail, and donor cultivation. Really, all the fundraising issues that make you wonder, am I doing this right? Is there a better way? There is. Find the Fundraising Fundamentals archive at tonymartinetti.com. That's MARTIGNETTI. Remember, there's a G before the N. Thousands of listeners have subscribed on iTunes. You can also learn more at the Chronicle website, philanthropy.com. Fundraising Fundamentals, the better way.
Welcome back to Big Nonprofit Ideas for the Other 95%. We're talking about cyber exposure, cyber breaches, and what can happen if you and your constituents are a victim, with Mark Shine, risk management consultant with Marsh & McLennan Agency. Okay, Mark. Right before the break, we were talking about notification.
Yes.
All right. You got to let the individuals know.
Yes. Yeah, so the individuals that were affected, right, that information could be compromised.
Attorney General, you mentioned?
So when the state where the individuals reside, you have to also notify that estate attorney general.
Oh, all those states.
Exactly.
Where all the people
exactly
are. You could be notifying 50 attorneys general.
47 different states have 47 different state breach notification laws, which make it so complicated in the event of a major breach where you have donors, you know, across multiple different states.
What are the three states where they don't care about their residents' breach of data? What are those three states?
When the callers call in after, we'll play the game and we'll let them call in and figure out if they could guess that.
Oh, we don't have live callers.
Okay.
You got to reveal it. Can you tell it? What are the three?
Sure. So it's some of the provinces.
Provinces?
Yes. We have 47 different states that have it. It's...
I put you on the spot.
Yeah, you're putting me on. Sure, no, it's not a problem. Okay. I'll get back on it, Tony.
All right. We got about 15 or 18 more minutes. Okay, that's all right. It just seems to me that, like, those states aren't protecting their citizens. I don't
sure.
In this narrow respect. Okay. Attorneys general, individuals, of course, and you mentioned carrier. I mean, if you have a cyber insurance carrier, they have to obviously know also.
Exactly, yeah. Because right. The cyber right. insurance pays for these exposure, the first party legal responsibilities, the notification that we just went over. Then the forensic cost. You need to figure out how the breach happened. What did they take? When did it stop?
Yeah.
Did you fix the issue? Now carriers will pay for the forensic investigation. You also have to provide credit monitoring for the affected individuals. Roughly about $20 per individual to provide credit monitoring.
Let me ask you about that part. The credit monitoring that I've seen with the breaches that I've been notified about, it's always been a year of credit monitoring.
Could be two.
Okay, I guess I haven't been lucky. I've always been one. So now, is that really valuable? Because I've read that this data is actually valuable 3 or 4 years later after it's been sold, and those of us who are the victims have forgotten about the breach. So we can't identify where it came from because it's like 2, 3, 4 years later, and the credit monitoring is long expired then.
Sure.
Is that true? I mean, is the data more valuable to a bad guy a few years after the breach?
Typically, the data, when it's out in the market, it's most valuable when it first comes out.
When it first comes out?
When it first comes out, precisely. You know, you look at a credit card. You know, my credit card has been compromised before where there's been fraudulent charges.
Right.
The next day, my credit card provider sends me a new credit card.
Right. Okay. Credit card. I could see that. But what if it's date of birth,
sure,
address, you know, maybe it's a password too for a site? I mean, doesn't that have residual value? You know, like years later?
Sure.
As well?
So you always want to make sure that you have it for when a company is going to offer credit monitoring in the event of a data breach. You always want to make sure that you're taking the full limits of whatever they're giving, whether it's a year or two. Can information be used 5, 6, 7, 10 years down the road? Yeah, absolutely. But if the entity is going to be able to provide you with 2 years of credit monitoring, it's better than running around without it after your information was just out there and compromised.
Okay. And I guess in terms of the credit card example, I mean, that would cover you that way, but usually those get, as you said, I mean, those get canceled immediately. All right. All right. So we're going to get to the insurance, you know, the details of insurance. So does that cover, like, what does that cover? Everything that the organization should do if they do suffer a breach, these notifications,
yes,
anything
sure.
else?
So they provide the notifications,
yes.
they deal with the data breach codes, they can do a forensic investigation. You know, some entities will be responsible for PCI fines or penalties, or reissuing debit cards or credit cards.
Yeah.
These are all different coverages that can be now implemented within a privacy and network security policy. Within insurance, when we look at most other insurance policies, whether it's workers' comp, general liability, a professional, an E&O exposure, whatever it may be, it's all based off of an ISO form. And with the ISO form...
Whoa. Jargon jail.
Yeah, okay.
ISO form.
Yes.
Yeah, what's ISO?
So ISO is the Insurance Services Organization.
Okay.
And what they are is they basically provide a vanilla form or a vanilla suggestion, and each carrier is then able to change it a little bit. And that's what they've done to help develop property, liability, auto, so on and so forth. When we look at cyber, there is no ISO form. So one carrier can be all the way on one side of the room offering terms and conditions. Another carrier can be all the way on the other side, and the prices and the terms can be wildly different, and the coverages.
Okay. Okay. We're still going to get to that in more detail. I want to flesh out a little something that you mentioned now twice. The data breach coach.
Yes.
What is his or her job? Who is that?
Sure. So typically what happens is each insurer will have a panel counsel, or they'll let you select your data breach coach. And they will walk you through what your liabilities are, who to speak to, who not to speak to, what you should be saying, what you should not, what your first party legal responsibilities are. They're going to be your end-all, be-all guide.
Okay. And they come from the carrier?
Typically, yes.
Okay, or recommended by the carrier, something like that?
Typically, it comes from a panel counsel that the carriers have already selected.
Okay, okay. All right, so why don't we get into a little bit of detail about different types of policies. Now, to protect yourself, to protect your organization. I know there's cyber insurance and there's cyber liability. These are two different categories of coverage?
All interchangeable.
Okay. Same thing. Yep. Really? Okay. All right.
Privacy and network security is the technical term. Cyber insurance or cyber liability is the street name, if you will.
Okay. I'm a street guy. Okay. All right. So, what are we looking for if we want to be out in the cyber insurance policy marketplace?
Sure.
What features should we be looking for?
Well, I think it really depends on, you know, the entity and what their concerns are, because you want to make sure that this coverage specifically is highly customized for the specific business. So one of your non-for-profits that might have 500 employees might have a dramatically different exposure than a company who has 50 employees out in North Dakota. So we need to, again, figure out what their true exposures are. So we work with a client like we do on a daily basis, talk to them, figure out what their risk tolerance is. Because cyber insurance, although it's a technical challenge, the risks still is transferred to an insurance carrier, or it's held within to an entity itself.
Now, are there policies that are for small organizations? Like, suppose an organization has just 8 or 10 employees. Maybe they have 1,500 donors, 2,000 sure. donors. They have some credit card info that they're saving, which I guess we could talk about whether they really need to save it or just mm-hmm. transact with it, but they've got that. They've got some personal information because they like to send paper mail as well, and they've got email addresses. Is there coverage for a smaller organization like that?
Absolutely. You could get privacy and network security for a company smaller than that.
Okay.
And so absolutely, size is not an issue when it comes to obtaining this type of coverage.
Okay. I don't suppose it's possible to. I mean, The premiums are going to vary wildly depending on what the risk exposure is like. So can't really ask. No point really in asking what a premium thing would look like. All right. I don't think, right?
You hit the nail on the head. It varies dramatically between the amount of records that you have, the type of information that you're collecting, the way that you're storing the information. All of those play factors in when trying to quantify what the premiums would be for a cyber liability policy.
All right. I hit the nail on the head twice. Twice in one interview. It's
doing good.
That's a record. Thank you. Now, should a vendor of these kinds of policies be able to help you determine whether you're saving info that you don't need to save? And, you know, going to the points that you just mentioned, and if you are, and with the info that you are saving, so are you saving stuff you don't need to?
Sure.
And what you are you saving it in the right way, under the right security? Is that part of this, or that's something separate?
No, it's absolutely. We want to make sure that we understand the culture of the business, and we want to make sure that they take cybersecurity to the highest regard. In 2017, this is one of the crown jewels, the intangible information that a business has on their donors, their clients, etc. So typically what we like to recommend is some type of vulnerability and penetration testing, an ongoing test that will say where you guys are from a security standpoint right now, what the culture looks like, what's changed, and it kind of gives you a snapshot in time of where we currently stand.
Oh, this sounds very sophisticated. Vulnerability and penetration testing.
Correct.
excuse me. Who does the Who runs a test like that? I mean, is that something a vendor could offer?
Cybersecurity firms.
Oh, firms. Oh, okay. So you would have to engage a firm to go and attack your sites, your social media,
your internal networks, your servers, things of that nature. Exactly.
Okay. All right. What else should we be thinking about as we're going out into the marketplace?
I think it's even before you go out to the marketplace, that's really what your listeners need to think about is the proactive steps that they can do in order to make themselves a better risk. So when they're out in the marketplace, a carrier wants to give them more favorable terms. So doing things like creating an incident response plan that basically says who's in charge of what information, who's going to be notifying who in the event of a data breach, what information was classified where, who had access to what, all of those different types of questions. You want to make sure that you have that document in hand. It's kind of like a fire drill back when you're in elementary school.
Okay. Yeah.
You want to make sure when the fire happens, you knew exactly where to meet the teacher at the corner of the road. It's the same thing when a data breach happens. You want to know exactly who's going to be dealing with the vendors and who had access to the information. The time to figure this out is before a breach, not after a breach.
Yeah, you're in a crisis.
You're in precisely. Crisis mode. Third time in the interview, you hit the
Look
nail.
Look, this
man.
Guy's coming back. Oh my God. Okay. Yes, you're in crisis, and all right. What else? These are things that you mentioned, underwriter. So. These are things you can do that will bring your policy, your premium down, right? You'll look more favorable to an insurer.
You will be more favorable. Risk.
Yeah.
The more that you put involved in your ingoing efforts on cybersecurity, the better off that a business is going to be going forward.
Okay.
We
cool.
don't see intangible property going away anytime soon. More people, more entities are collecting more information in 2017 than ever before.
Yeah.
This is a trend that's not going away. So we advise our clients to be proactive rather than reactive.
All right.
And that's what we work with them on.
What else besides the incident response plan could we be doing proactively?
Sure. Well, you want to engage with an attorney to, again, draw the incident response plan. You want to make sure you're doing your vulnerability and penetration testing.
Okay, that's a thing, too. All
you
right.
want to deal with your cyber insurance broker to make sure that the things on the applications are actually being done and you're not making a material misrepresentation when filling out an application.
Mm.
So if you
That's bad. That's bad.
Absolutely.
If you're claiming claiming you have a plan or you've done vulnerability testing or something and then there's a claim and it turns out that you haven't, that can be trouble.
Precisely. We don't want to lie on an application. We make sure that our clients are truthful and we work with them to find the best carrier for their certain circumstances.
Okay. Anything else we can do proactively before we're in crisis mode or we're just maybe as part of our strategic plan,
sure.
we're planning for this? What else can we do?
If there's one thing that I can recommend to the management of the non-for-profits that listen to this radio station, you want to make sure that you're training your employees. The employee error factor can be the difference between a data breach and a non-data breach. If they know what to look for in terms of a phishing attack that can lead to some type of ransomware, these are all types of methods now that entities or individuals are using to try and breach a company. So we want to make sure that we train our employees thoroughly what to look out for, what to click on, what not to click on. That's one of the biggest things that I would recommend when I go out and I do my talks is employee training, because employee error, unfortunately, causes a tremendous amount of breaches.
Okay. Yeah. We've been thinking about the bad actors coming in.
Right.
But you can keep them from coming in.
Precisely.
If you don't click on the attachment that Precisely. You weren't expecting or it doesn't look familiar to you.
And on the same point of the employee training, what happens when the employee sent an email to Jane Doe and it was supposed to go to John Doe? And now all of that census information or the credit cards from your donors are now out there in the public. Well, now you have a data breach. So again, making sure the right protocols are in place so an email doesn't get sent to John Doe, and it's supposed to go to Jane Doe originally.
Yeah.
Right. So employee training, I can't stress it enough, is one of the biggest things.
I get your passion. I feel it. It's palpable in the studio. What else can we be training on then? This is valuable for people who even may not be, they may not be in the insurance marketplace, or they may not be out looking, but there are things that they can do to help protect themselves.
Sure.
What else can we include in employee training around this?
Sure. So you want to make sure that you have policies and procedures in place, classification policies, things of that nature.
Classification of
the information. What information was segmented? Was all of your information on your server, was the secretary able to access the same information as the CEO?
Yes, levels, right. So levels of employee access.
Exactly. That's what we call classification.
Classification. Okay. You find that in database.
Precisely.
Programs or apps typically. you know, somebody's a super user. Only certain people can see social security numbers.
Precisely.
Or have access to and things like that. Yeah.
And you want to make sure, again, the CEO is able to see certain information that perhaps the, you know, the rank and file doesn't necessarily need to see.
Okay.
So if there's information out there that is highly sensitive and employees don't need to see it, there's no reason to give them access to it.
Right. You need to have a business need.
Exactly.
A business need.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. So it's just, again, doing your due diligence ahead of time rather than post.
Okay. Anything else? Employee training. This is gold. This is really, this is gold for listeners. So, what else can we include in employee training?
Again, I think we hit on a bunch of the major
points.
That's it? Okay. We, you know, if you like, one of your guests, I could put you in touch with a good friend of mine who does some of the training, and they could go into more detail. But my really experience is qualifying and quantifying what a breach could come or cost a not-for-profit, and how it comes to the bottom line of their P&L.
Right. Okay. Okay. Now, we still have some more time left. So let's, okay, like 2 or 3 minutes left. Or
sure.
So what haven't I asked you that you want to talk about?
I think the trends of the way that the breaches have been happening.
Okay.
We're seeing now certain, the carriers are now changing the policies because of the way that the attacks are happening.
Yeah, what's happening?
It's things like social engineering, social deception, that's now, you can now get incorporated into the cyber liability policies.
What is this social engineering, social deception? What is this?
So, have you heard about the types of emails that are coming to the C-suites or the rank and file from a C-suite saying, can you make a payment to XYZ company? We're looking to acquire somebody.
Right.
We call it voluntary parting of funds. And this is now the need for a holistic point of view from a risk management standpoint when looking at a cyber exposure, because this is a part where the crime policy and the cyber policy can interlie to try and provide coverage. So it may not just be crime, may not just be cyber, but if you have the overlap of the two, that might be the best form. So we want to make sure that we truly, again, understand the client's specific needs, because what we've talked about today was all generalizations.
We need to understand
their actual risk profile.
Now, you mentioned a crime policy. Now, this is something we haven't talked about. This is something unrelated, right?
Yep, precisely.
That's just coverage against crimes against the organization?
Different types of crimes could be, you know, for this, the voluntary parting of funds if somebody's willing to transfer monies.
Yeah.
If
sounds so innocuous, voluntary parting of funds. That sounds like I write my niece a check. And that's a voluntary parting of fund. I gave her $50 for her birthday.
Yeah.
She's young. That's why it's $50 is enough. I don't want you to think I'm a cheap uncle.
You wanted to give your niece the $50. Typically, when these are going on, this is a bad actor that had tricked an employee to release the funds.
Like your example. Okay.
Precisely.
Well, all right. Thank you very much. We're going to leave it there.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, guys.
Thank you for being in the studio. Mark Schein. You'll find him at M-S-C-H-E-I-N, and then his credentials, C-I-C-C-L-C-S. Thank you very much again, Mark.
Thanks, Don. Appreciate it.
The very timely discussion we had, because just today, 16 health facilities in Britain were breached. People couldn't reach their own data. Medical facilities couldn't reach patient data. Patients had to be diverted. That's just today's headline. We got Maria Semple coming up with Beyond Online to IRL. First Pursuant, they've got a new paper. It's free, of course. Lots of free content from Pursuant. Breakthrough Fundraising, Achieve the Impossible with a New Way of Thinking. What is breakthrough thinking? And can you say it? And how do you get it to help, use it to help you overcome your organization's challenges, like speaking and moving lips and tongue in precise ways that will actually form syllables which turn into words and sentences. How do you do that? Breakthrough thinking, of course. How do you set a breakthrough outcome? How do you make sure that outcome is going to reach far enough and achieve something that seems out of reach to you but is not? All right. Identifying actionable strategies to create a culture of breakthrough. That's what's all in this paper. Learn breakthrough fundraising. You can learn it. Go to pursuant.com, click resources, then content papers. I hope you have more success reading it than I did talking about it. We Be Spelling. Do you need to raise more money? Want to engage millennials? Perhaps host a fundraising spelling bee. It's a night out at a local place that's devoted to raising money for your nonprofit. Check out their video at webeespelling.com and then get in touch with CEO Alex Greer. Very nice guy. Stupendous guy. He's an amazing guy. I love this guy. Alex Greer, CEO. And you'll find out more. He'll fill you in. Now time for Tony's Take Two. Are you properly registered in each state where you solicit donations? I'm wagging my finger at you. If you are a Northern Louisiana charity, perhaps, and you're sending email to Southern Arkansas, you need to register in both states. If you're an Eastern Oregon nonprofit and you're hosting an event in Western Idaho, you need to register in both. Wherever you are, if you mail solicitation pieces to retirees in Florida, you need to register down there. Don't get caught with your shorts down, please. That reminds me, I wrote that, but then this reminds me of this company truck that I saw once. It said, Ganser Electric, let us check your shorts. I love that. That reminds me of another one. It was roofing, Fiedler Roofing. It's only done right if there's a Fiedler on the roof. I love those. I don't know, it's Ganser Electric and Fiedler Roofing. They're out there somewhere. Okay, charity registration, back to that. I can help you if you want help. I can help you do it. The video explaining what you got to do and what this is all about is at tonymartinetti.com. And that is Tony's Take Two. You're probably very much looking forward to Maria Semple because it's a little rough today. So let's get Maria Semple to do a lot of talking, and we'll just have Sam bring my mic down. She's the prospect finder. She's a trainer and speaker on prospect research. Her latest book is Magnify Your Business, Tips, Tools, and Strategies for Growing Your Business or Your Nonprofit. She's our doyen of dirt cheap and free. She's at theprospectfinder.com and at Maria Semple. Welcome back, Maria.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
And you're in the studio today.
Absolutely.
That's always special, in the studio.
Sure is.
It's not a great day to be in the studio with me, even though the first part was pre-recorded. I don't know. You can help me change the trajectory.
There you go.
Of my performance.
Yeah. Don't take your mic down, because then it's no fun.
Okay. Well, that's a debatable question. Typically, I would agree with you. All right. So we're talking about going on beyond online. And this is actually a topic that I think brought you and I together in early days, back when I used to write blog posts, actually write words. I wrote something on the value of going, not only just researching online, but the value of actually talking
right
to your potential donors. And I'm pretty sure you commented on it.
Yeah, probably.
That was one of the early things that brought us together.
Yeah. So, so many times when you think about prospect research, and even on the shows that we've had, we've really focused a lot on the online stuff,
yeah, for
right?
Sure.
The technology and, how can we get information? But, we haven't spent a lot of time talking about, well, what are some of those offline strategies, those people-to-people strategies that you can use to elicit some great information? And, sometimes when I'm sitting there typing up profiles on individuals, there are things that I guess out of curiosity really want to know about that person. I want to know more about what makes them tick, and
like the strength of their marriage. Are they estranged from their kids? Like those kinds of questions.
Well, maybe no, but I mean,
how do they get along with their parents?
Just really what their interests are. What are they really doing in the nonprofit sector?
More professional.
How are they spending? Okay. But maybe even how are they spending their free time? Like how do they spend it?
Yeah.
Are they volunteering? Are they, vacationing? Are they advocating? What are they doing? So very often I wish I could, call up that person that I'm researching and say, hey, I've got a couple of holes missing here in this profile. Right. And I'd love to ask you a few questions.
And I have thought, and going back to that blog post that I wrote years ago, the talking to the person, and there's other people we could talk to too. We're gonna talk about that. But talking to the person, I've always thought, is just a great source of information. You just ask open-ended questions,
right?
And you find out about not only about their interests within the organization,
right,
but their family circumstances, where they like to vacation. Who their friends are that might be affiliated with the organization or that they might be willing to bring in, and you find out so much if you would just.
Yeah.
Talk to people.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, you know, if you're doing the prospect research for the organization, I'm going to give you some questions to think about, but also you might think about seating your development staff, your executive director, and your board with some of these questions that they might just in their conversations with people, they might be able to ask, so that you can fill in maybe some holes that you might have on the donor profile that you might be, compiling on this person, or just, at some point filling in.
Now, you and I have talked about boards being valuable for prospect research.
Absolutely.
And occasionally, I think you advocate even regularly making part of a board member or board meetings or periodically list of prospects.
Yes.
As well as institutional funders.
Yeah.
Funders and people. These are the people in the organizations that are on our screen right now.
Yeah.
How can you help us with any of these?
Right, right. So it could be through that process that you could elicit the information. Another way you could potentially do this is, Tony, you've probably heard this phrase where if you want to get money, ask people for their opinion.
Yeah,
right? Ask them for their opinion and they'll give you money.
Yeah.
So if you can figure out a way to engage people either through a formal feasibility study or bring together some sort of small focus groups where you're really getting people engaged and asking them questions and making sure that they understand there's nothing behind this. You're not being brought in the room to solicit you in any way. We just really want your opinion. And I think that people start to feel more engaged and committed to an organization once they understand that, they want to know what I think about this organization and how to move it forward into the future. So I kind of came up with my top 10 questions that I thought I would love to ask.
Okay. We'll get to those. We're going to get there. So we mentioned the board as a good source.
Yep.
Focus groups.
Yes.
You're talking
focus
about
groups.
Staff. Your might be development staff, but not necessarily. Could be staff that's interacting with people in a different way besides fundraising.
That's right. So maybe it is staff that's involved with really just organizing your volunteers. So you might have a volunteer engagement person on staff that focuses on your special events, your runs, your walks, things like that. So they could be sort of armed with this set of questions as well. So they could just be kind of on their radar and be always looking to collect this type of data, because the type of data that we're about to talk about, a lot of times you just can't even find it online.
Yeah.
And I think it goes to really good development work to be able to source that data and fill in some of those holes and missing puzzle pieces, so to speak.
Now, this raises the question of social media. So when you're researching prospects, do you go to their social media accounts to see what might be public? Like if a lot of their Facebook posts are public. Now, some people keep them private, but or only to their friends, but Do you look at social media to try to fill in holes?
Well, I'll tell you what, I actually do
prospects.
Because one of the things that I do, of course, is I Google somebody's name.
Yeah.
So when I do that, and on page one of Google search results, very often will be their social media accounts, their LinkedIn, their Facebook, Instagram, right? So even you think, oh, okay, well, it's an Instagram account. It's all photos. What am I going to gain from that? But you can really gain a lot of information about
pictures of their second home.
Yeah.
Their boat, their plane.
Yeah. I mean, or just, maybe they're really into birding, for example. So they've got, a lot of pictures around that. And you think, oh, okay, well, gee, we're an environmental organization. We didn't realize they had this particular interest within our scope. So you can really maybe even learn a lot. They say a picture is worth a thousand words, right?
Oh boy,
so
you're just filled with the old the old sayings. Oh yes, I've heard that. So, gee, I've heard that too. Yes,
okay. For sure. And then let's not forget some of these platforms that also allow for video. So my goodness, when they then not only have photos up there, but then they're involving video as well.
Mm-hmm.
So if it's public, right, and it's not somehow password protected or privacy protected, then it's in the public domain.
Yeah. You're not going and friending all these prospects.
No.
To try to sneak in.
No.
And get their, become
not.
Their friends. Yeah.
Absolutely not.
You sure you're not?
No, okay. Absolutely okay. not. But all I will right. say that, one thing about the LinkedIn. If you're doing the research there, there is a way to set your privacy settings in such a way that you will, like if I'm researching you, Tony, or if I'm just looking at your LinkedIn profile, I go in as an anonymous user, so you won't know that I was looking at your profile.
Oh, really?
However, yeah. I give up the ability to see who's been looking at mine.
Oh, well, I wouldn't care about that. How do we set that?
So you go into the privacy settings, and one of the options is, you know, how you want to appear to others when you are looking at their profiles.
Yes.
There are three settings. There's one that's fully transparent. So your picture will be there, your name will be there, and your headline will be there, right? That's the setting that allows you to also then see who's been looking at your profile if you choose that setting.
Yeah.
Then there's two private settings. One is semi-private. So I could come across as just somebody who's in the management consulting industry in the greater New York City area.
Mm-hmm.
Or I could be anonymous.
Okay.
So those are the two private and semi-private settings.
So you're either naked, topless, or fully
That's
or
right.
fully clothed.
Or fully clothed.
Okay. All right, well, that's very interesting. I mean, I could care less who looks at mine. I get those emails. I know that's an option I can turn off, but I just haven't. But you know, whatever, 12, 14 people looked at your profile this week. I mean, I don't care.
Right.
And okay, but so now, so if I turn it off, but you can turn it on and off.
You can.
So if
turn
you don't
it
want,
it,
if you want to be. If you want to be naked sometimes and fully exposed, you could do that.
Yeah,
or if you want to put your clothes on, top and bottom, tops and bottoms, like jammies, like yeah. with the footsies and everything,
right?
And little bunny
slippers,
ears and everything,
yeah,
and a hood
yeah.
and a hoodie. You could do that too,
right?
Okay, you can go back and forth. All right, this is all online, and what I promised was we were going to go beyond online to in real life. But this is all valuable, so we do whatever the hell I want. Okay.
He's going rogue.
It's my show. No, it's not rogue. It's mainstream. It's mainstream. It's Tony Martinetti, Nonprofit Radio. All right. Now, you have questions that are good for in real life questions. So let's talk about some of those for a couple minutes before we take a break. So what kind of things should we be putting out into our, among our people? Because this is not just for us to be asking, but all the people that we
right.
talked about a few
yeah.
minutes ago.
And also, these would work really well in, like I said, a focus group or a feasibility study type of a situation. So
right.
question number one. What do you feel are the most pressing challenges for our community?
Okay.
I often can't find that type of information,
yeah.
right?
What?
So you're getting into the mind of that individual, and you're getting them to talk about what are the challenges that you see, not only with regard to the types of services that we provide, but in our community, what are the challenges that you see? And then, you know, hopefully from there, conversation will happen around, you know, how does this particular nonprofit even address any of those challenges?
Right.
And it may not be appropriate.
Okay. And in fact, that's your next suggestion. What role do you see nonprofits playing resolving the issues
right.
that are pressing for you?
Exactly.
That you feel are, you know, I like this, you know, what do you feel? Because you're asking the person, what's their opinion? What are their feelings about
right.
something? It's
right.
good, open-ended questions.
Yeah. You definitely want to make sure that they are open-ended and not just yes or no questions.
Right.
Because
right.
what you're looking to do here is really just listen. And I think that, you know, this is something that I think especially those of us in the Northeast, right, we're so used to talk, that we have trouble just listening.
I don't know. You may have that trouble. I don't feel I have that trouble.
Well, you know, you're already transitioning to the South.
Yeah,
and so.
Well, slowly, but no, there's a slight degree of sarcasm. Okay. So, you know, how do you see us fitting into it?
Yeah. How do you see our nonprofit
yeah.
fitting into this, into
right.
addressing
right.
this particular need? You know, how can we help address this need in our community? Is it appropriate for us to be addressing this need within our community?
Yeah, right. Do you feel like this should be a priority for us? Yeah, it is or it isn't. And some of these, I think, are things that, I mean, I hope that frontline fundraisers have in mind, and they are asking people, you know, at least these last couple that we talked about, you know, what are we doing right? How do you think we fit in? How do you feel about the work that we do? How does it fit into the community? You know, what else should we be hitting on that we're not? Things like that. All right, we got to go take our break. When we come back, we got live listener love, et cetera, et cetera. Stay with us.
Like what you're hearing on Nonprofit Radio? Tony's got more. On YouTube, you'll find clips from his stand-up comedy, TV spots, and exclusive interviews. Catch guests like Seth Godin, Craig Newmark, the founder of Craigslist, Mark Echo of Echo Enterprises, Charles Best from DonorsChoose.org, Aria Finger of DoSomething.org, and Naomi Levine from New York University's Hyman Center on Philanthropy. Tony tweets, too. He finds the best content from the most knowledgeable and interesting people in and around nonprofits to share on his stream. If you have valuable info, he wants to retweet you. During the show, you can join the conversation on Twitter using hashtag Nonprofit Radio. Twitter is an easy way to reach Tony. He's at Tony Martinetti, MARTIGNETTI. Remember, there's a G before the N. He hosts a podcast for the Chronicle of Philanthropy. Fundraising Fundamentals is a short, monthly show devoted to getting you over your fundraising hurdles. Just like Nonprofit Radio, Tony talks to leading thinkers, experts, and cool people with great ideas. As one fan said, "Tony picks their brains and I don't have to leave my office." Fundraising Fundamentals was recently dubbed the most helpful nonprofit podcast you have ever heard. You can also join the conversation on Facebook, where you can ask questions before or after the show. The guests are there, too. Get insider show alerts by email. Tony tells you who's on each week and always includes links so that you can contact guests directly. To sign up, visit the Facebook page or TonyMartinetti.com.
I'm Chuck Longfield of Blackbaud, and you're listening to Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio, big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%.
We have got live listeners all over the country. It's amazing. We're booming today from New Bern, North Carolina, Bradenton, Florida, and Tampa, Florida. This is a first for Nonprofit Radio, for sure. We've got all five boroughs of the city checked in. Bayside and Rosedale in Queens, Bronx, can't see your neighborhood, Brooklyn, can't see your neighborhood, Manhattan, and Staten Island. We've got all five boroughs checked in. Live listener love throughout the city of New York, throughout the five boroughs. Also, Blairstown, New Jersey. I used to go to Boy Scout camp in Blairstown. Nobi Bosco stood for North Bergen Boy Scouts. Nobi Bosco. I was in Blairstown, and that's where they filmed Friday the 13th, one of Kevin Bacon's early movies. Friday the 13th, filmed at that Boy Scout camp in Blairstown, New Jersey. Live listener love to you, Blairstown. Also, Woodbridge, New Jersey is with us. I don't know where Old Tappan, New Jersey is, where my mother and father are. They did not check in. They're checking out or something. I don't know, but they're not checked in. We got all the way West Coast, Kent, Washington. Live listener love out to the upper Northwest. And I think that's everybody so far in the U.S. of A. How about Germany? Multiple cities in Germany. Guten Tag. Spain? I can't see your city. I'm sorry, but Spain. Buenos tardes. And we've got a newcomer. In the area of East Azerbaijan, the town is Tabriz, and that's Iran. Welcome, Iran. Live listener love to you in Iran. Give us a high five from Iran. On the heels of the live listener love, of course, comes the podcast pleasantries. Maria Semple is getting close to her mic, thinking that it's her time to talk again, but it's not quite, because we got to do the podcast pleasantries. She's trying to cut you off, podcast listeners. She doesn't want me to do it, but her restraints are feeble against my will to do podcast pleasantries to the over 12,000 listeners. Whenever you are, whatever device, I am so glad you're with us. Pleasantries to you and the affiliate affections to our AM and FM listeners throughout the country. So glad that you are with us as well. Affections to you on those analog devices. Glad you're with us. Okay, Maria Semple. Now it's back your turn. You can sit up straight again. Maria Semple, you'll find her at theprospectfinder.com, and she's at Maria Semple. More questions. Okay. We got some more questions that we'd like to be asking.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So these next two questions are very interrelated, and they may be difficult for you to ask directly to someone. It might work better in more of a group situation. And I think it would work really well if you had, I'm going to say, a third party, maybe a consultant or other volunteers, perhaps mm-hmm. asking this question. So the questions are, what are we doing right and what can we improve? Because I think you're going to learn a lot about how your organization is serving the community. And maybe there is some gaps that these potential donors feel that you're not filling, but should be filling.
Yes.
So that
sounds particularly suited to a focus group. Right. Or a feasibility study, a consultant asking feasibility study questions of individuals or couples one-on-one.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Absolutely.
What else you got?
And this next question really has to do more with your communications and how you're communicating with people. And, are we transparent and communicating effectively regarding our programs and achievements? I think that fundraising and communications, marketing, PR, whatever you want to call it, they cannot live in silos. They absolutely are interrelated. When mm-hmm. one part of that is not going well, it's going to impact the other side and vice versa. So I think it is important to have an understanding of, are you over-communicating, under-communicating? You know, sometimes donors feel like, the only time we ever hear from this organization is when they're asking for money.
Yeah, that's always bad, of course.
Right? Right. So, are you adequately communicating?
And also, how would you like to be communicated with?
Right.
Do you prefer email, paper mail, phone, Twitter? You know, how would you like us to be talking to you?
Right, exactly.
Through what channels?
Okay. Yep.
Okay.
And this next question I really like, because now we're going to start to understand, will these people be willing to make a major
gift commitment?
Why is this
number 7, then? If you like this one, why is this number 7?
Well, no, I mean, because now we're getting into more of a major gift flow of questions,
right?
Oh, okay,
right? There's an arc to this.
Right?
There's a narrative
right?
to this. We're approaching denouement.
Right, there you go.
And then we're gonna leave the zenith. Okay.
Right, exactly.
Yes, denouement.
So have you ever made a multi-year commitment to a nonprofit organization, and would you ever consider doing so?
Yeah.
So not necessarily to your nonprofit,
right,
but to a nonprofit organization.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay. You need to go through the next couple quickly.
Okay, great.
We only have a few minutes left, and we got to talk about conferences. So
okay, great.
Just read them off.
All right. So how many nonprofits do you typically support in a given year? Do you give more to an organization when you are involved in its leadership?
All right, okay. Would you like to be a board member, right. et cetera, volunteer?
Yep.
Okay.
And who else should we be talking to?
Excellent. Right.
Who else should
who of your in your network can you bring to us?
Right. Who in your circle of influence should we be talking to?
All right. Excellent. In real life, go there. Don't ignore the in real life. It's part of you being a human being. It's not all digital. Okay. Let's go to conferences. If you want to meet in real life, we have an APRA conference, the Association of Professional Researchers in Advancement, right? Where's that?
That's
conference?
Right. So their big annual conference, it's their 30th actually, is happening in Anaheim, California this year on July 26th through the 29th.
Are you going to be there?
I am not. No, I'm not going to be attending it this year, but I do want to make sure that everybody is aware that it's there in case they want to get some extra education. And this information, as well as a lot of this other stuff I'm going to bring up now, is all available on APRA's website, which is aprahome.org. So that's aprahome.org.
Okay.
So that's the big international conference. A bunch of statewide stuff just passed in April, but a couple of other upcoming things that I did want to bring to your attention. So if you are members of the Florida chapter of APRA, they've got a state conference coming up June 8th through the 9th.
Okay.
We've got an APRA Overdrive one-day conference coming up in Seattle, Washington, May 25th. There's a couple of webinars coming up, a free one on June 15th, Getting the Most Out of Wealth Screening. And they've got one that they're running in conjunction with AFP called You Can Do It, Research at Your Fingertips. And that's going to be on August 23rd.
Now, info about all of these is available on aprahome.org?
Yes, it is. That's exactly where I got it from.
Okay, very good. We got to leave it there. She's the Prospect Finder. Again, at Maria Semple and at theprospectfinder.com. Thank you so much for being in the studio.
I was so glad to be here.
Pleasure. I am too. Voice crack like a 14-year-old. It's unbelievable. Next week, healthcare funding options and Gene Takagi is back. If you missed any part of today's show, I beseech you, find it on TonyMartinetti.com. We're sponsored by Pursuant, online tools for small and mid-sized nonprofits, data-driven and technology-enabled. And by WeBe Spelling, super cool spelling bee fundraisers, WeBeeSpelling.com. Our creative producer is Claire Meyerhoff. Sam Leibowitz is the line producer. Betty McCardle is our AM and FM outreach director. The show's social media is by Susan Chavez, and this cool music is by Scott Stein. Be with me next week for Nonprofit Radio, big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. Hopefully I'll be more articulate. Go out and be great.
What's not to love about Nonprofit Radio? Tony gets the best guests. Check this out from Seth Godin.
This is the first revolution since TV 1950 and Henry Ford 1920. It's the revolution of our lifetime.
Here's a smart, simple idea from Craigslist founder Craig Newmark.
Yeah, in sites or in presentation or anything, people don't really need the fancy stuff. They need something which is simple and fast.
When's the best time to post on Facebook? Facebook's Andrew Noyes knows.
At traffic is at an all-time high around 9 a.m. or 8 p.m. So that's when you should be posting your most meaningful posts.
Here's Aria Finger, COO of DoSomething.org.
Young people are not going to be involved in social change if it's boring and they don't see the impact of what they're doing. So you got to make it fun and applicable to these young people, because otherwise a 15 and 16-year-old, they have better things to do. They have Xbox, they have TV, they have their cell phones.
Ami Dar is the founder of Idealist.
It took 2 or 3 years for foundation staff to sort of deign to add an email address to their card. Yeah, it was like, yes. It was phone. This email thing is right. Weird. And plus, why should I give it away?
Charles Best founded DonorsChoose.org.
Somehow they've gotten in touch, kind of offline, as it were.
Yeah.
And they'll do exchanges of brownies and visits and physical gift.
Mark Echo is the founder and CEO of Echo Enterprises. You may be wearing his hoodies and shirts. Tony talked to him.
Yeah, you know, I'm a big believer that it's not what you make in life. It's you know, it's how you make people feel.
This is public radio host Majora Carter.
Innovation is in the power of understanding that you don't just, you know, you just put money on a situation and expect it to heal. You put money on a situation and invest it and expect it to grow.
And savvy advice for success from Eric Saperston.
What separates those who achieve from those who do not is in direct proportion to one's ability to ask others for help.
The smartest experts and leading thinkers are on Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio. Big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%.